Hello and welcome to a new episode of Challenger Cities with me, Ian Montgomery. And I'm really looking forward to this episode because I have Hayden Clarkin, who I've interviewed before as part of another podcast that we did with a company called Bolden Networks and Chris Duchette, my then client, now friend and colleague. And Hayden's really interesting because he's known as the transit guy on social media, and he will share really interesting posts and get hundreds and thousands of likes on things, really comparing like what America and Canada get wrong when it comes to transportation and busting down a lot of the excuses of, hang on, how does this work in a place in Europe that has a similar geography, similar population, similar income, similar geography, but America can't do this and relies on cars and maybe has the odd slow train once a day. Anyway, I got him in because I didn't really necessarily want to talk about transit per se, but more, he wrote an article on Substack and it really triggered me because it was looking at what do the Democrats need to do better to win an election in 4 years' time. There's so much stuff that we kind of value process over outcomes, and we did all the steps, but we then ended up with something that was kind of mediocre. And it's really hard to then sometimes have those conversations and debates with people that might have political views that you don't agree with, but some of the things that they believe will solve problems that we can't deny. And the incumbents have to do something about changing the broken processes and systems that simply don't work. Because otherwise the alternative is an organization or a government or a leaning that doesn't necessarily want to reform them, but wants to get rid of them. So I think this is really a conversation about how cities can reform and how to think of changing institutions. Please do read his Substack. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But I really enjoyed this conversation because I think we jump all over the place, but it really comes down to like, actually, what do we have to reform to go and create brilliant Challenger Cities? So that's enough waffling from me. Without further ado, here is a really fun interview with Hayden Clarkin, aka the Transit Guy. Hayden, thank you so much for being voluntold into one of my podcasts again. I really, really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me.
You triggered me with a really eloquent, thoughtful, provocative Substack article. I think it was your first Substack article a week or two ago. I want to ask you all about that. But before we do that, the people who are listening to this who don't know who you are, and you are known very, very well on social media as the Transit. Let's get into a little bit about like Hayden, the Transit Guy.
Sure. So thanks for having me. I was a civil engineering and German major at the University of Connecticut. I always kind of grew up loving trains and buses, but because we didn't have them in Rhode Island, really, to a level that like I could pursue a job, I kind of love the idea of like large scale mega projects. And so that's really what I wanted to do, was get into mega projects. And then when I went to the University of Connecticut, one of my first days in engineering class, I met a professor named Dr. Norman Garrick, who is, if anyone knows, is around the New Urbanist Movement. He was a founder of the New Urbanist Movement, really talks about kind of instead of moving cars, we're just moving people. And so the paradigm kind of shifted and my life changed as to how I see things. You know, went to Germany for a year, studied public transportation operation, then moved back stateside and moved to California, where I worked on the West Coast on a bunch of subway projects, bus rapid transit projects, street projects, all of the fun kind of projects, very large high-speed rail project, or just a very large rail project in general. So had a really great time doing that. And the funny thing, which I think is something that we can talk about, is I was working at a firm, and the firm that I was in, or the department I was in transit. And I was the only person in the transit department who took transit every day to work. And one of the projects we were working on was literally extending a subway under the building in which we were in. And so it was kind of ironic and also stark that I was really just the only person who took the train every day. And so when we were, our employer was talking about employee benefits and, oh, do you want your park validated or do you want your transit pass? I was the one who wanted the transit pass. And so I kind of always brought up a big stink about it. And so one of my coworkers one day said, oh yeah, that's Hayden. He's the transit guy here. And so I don't know if they said it kind of cheekily. And then I just was like, okay, it's stuck, at least within the office. And then when lockdown happened and I kind of started this alter ego of the transit guy, I was like, okay, I'm going to go as the transit guy online. And it's stuck now for about 4 years, almost 5 years. So
it clearly works as well. You're an authority on Twitter or X, whatever we want to call it these days. But you're an authority on these sorts of things. And the thing that first drew me to seeing your stuff was like, I think you would take an American city of a certain size, landmass, and be like, how the hell can this not have any transit? And this other thing in Europe be like, small city, it's got four tram lines, it's got express routes, it's got high-speed rail station. And I think it like shows us that we, like, the economics can work, we just choose to make them work. And, like, hopefully we're seeing a shift in them. Whether we continue to with the new administration, who knows?
Yeah, I think Canadians and Americans have really never seen public transit work since at least the Second World War. And so there's a lot of like people who are just jaded around transit, and they've just never seen it work in a way that they want to support. The reason, you know, New York City Transit gets so much support for its projects is because people use it all the time. It's in the cultural zeitgeist. You know, like, it's just human behavior at this point to use the train as like your first mode of travel. And in most parts of the country, literally even 15 miles outside of New York City's borders, that's not the case. And so there's this kind of chicken or the egg in which we need to get really great transformative transit so that people ride it, so that people support it, so that like we can kind of compound on it. And so that's kind of what I bring up a lot of times when people say like, oh, well, we're not, you know, Zurich, Switzerland, so we can't have 500 and something trains a day, right? Like, well, why can't we? And then bringing up historical reason as to like, hey, America and Canada had some of the best passenger rail systems in the world, and we dismantled them. So a lot of times when I'm talking about, you know, transit projects, I'm really talking about just restoring what we have. I'm really not like changing anything drastic here. I'm not reinventing.
Where did we go wrong? Obviously, there's the whole car lobby and like the automotive industry, but there's something deeper in that in the governance model.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could honestly have a podcast about this, and there have been books written about kind of all of this, like, myriad of issues as to what happened. And so really, it really started at the Second World War, and I'll speak for America mostly, just because, or the United States, just because of my own purview and my own understanding of history. But after the Second World War, all of our boys and girls coming back home, we gave them basically tract homes outside of the city. We're doing this new thing of the suburbs, and Levittown in New York was built, and it was enticing. And by the way, you don't have to put any money down. You can get these like tract homes, really. I mean, I don't know the other better way for them. And that spread across the country. And then in the 50s, we had white flight. We had the real renaissance of the car happening really in the 40s to the 60s. And so, hey, look at this shiny highway that we can have. Look at the world stage. And the World Fair has this cool highway product, and we can have it. And we could like live with in the future. Like, we're the Jetsons, right? And so we saw this major decentralization of all of our cities. And so this kind of dense cities that we all had, I mean, really almost every city, not a post-suburban 1980 town, had a historical kind of nucleus. And slowly but surely, it started to dissipate. And with that, we basically relied on cars, and we built most of our built environment around cars. And now we find this chicken or the egg of, how do we right size this ship? And it's really hard to do. And the only reason, like Europe also fell to this, but to a lesser extent, because they had such historical cultural love for their cities and such reverence that like Rome never got a freeway like next to the Vatican, right? But like that could have happened in New York City. Like Greenwich Village was supposed to be raised for a highway. Like there were so many highway fights. And so all of these kind of legacy cities that were, you know, unscathed from the highway, both globally and in North America, they also were threatened with like highways running right through them. And in some cases, it did happen. So that's where we're at.
There's something about like when the transit comes first, you've got a structure that even if you get threatened by the car, you can still do something with it almost. I saw someone who used to work for Transport for London, and like that's the kind of case of there's these neighborhoods that you can have relatively limited density, still single family homes, still have gardens, but like the houses are close enough together, and the transit was there first. So like the default becomes you get the tube into central London. Whereas I feel like New York didn't have that.
Yeah. And I think almost everyone who's probably listening to this in Canada, American, can definitely attest to this. There really is kind of such a large car dependency. You know, like we have this thing called, the streetcar suburb in America, right? Where these were suburbs that came and were built around the interurban lines. And so we're thinking of like places like Berkeley, California, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Evanston, Illinois. Evanston, Illinois is like one of my favorite examples because Evanston, Illinois is this grid city that's served by buses, rail, the L, all of these kind of different modes, and has like 10,000 people per square mile, which is higher than almost 8 out of the 10 biggest cities in America, right? So it's like we really built these beautiful garden suburbs, these like leafy suburbs. And then when the inception of the car happened, we really then started to just like break out what a suburb looks like. And so suburbs now today look like, you know, Plano, Texas, or Evanston, Illinois, or Berkeley, California. And those look completely different. And some people think they're cities. And so, you know, yeah, it's really hard to put that back into the box once it's been unwound. And I don't know if we're be able to do that. I think we can definitely make on the margins, you know, fix a lot. But yeah, that is the problem. And in places like Evanston, you have a subway line in which single family homes were built around this transit node, right? And in most cases nowadays, with everything being built around the car, the trains are like, well, we'll put them through a freeway, we'll put them on the side of a major arterial, right? There's no sort of built environment that was built around it, regardless of the density. And so that's kind of what we're suffering now. And riders and transit agencies suffer from that greatly.
There's an interesting thing of over the past, like definitely the last 4 years, probably over the past 10, 15, 20, a lot more money and time and effort and resources gone into thinking, hang on, this city thing isn't sustainable with the way we've done it over the past our generation. But we've not made that much progress. And I feel like we were starting to make progress, but at the same time, like probably weren't getting great value for it. When we build a new subway line or rail line in North America, it costs a fortune. And I thought, I didn't actually know about this, but like the first thing you pointed out in your Substack was the La Sombrita, which looks like the world's worst bus stop. And I'm just fascinated.
Are you sure? It looks like a great bus shelter to me. I don't know why.
It looks like, I don't understand how smart people and a lot of money and a lot of time and effort got to that. It's almost like you would have been better off letting Homer Simpson design it.
Right. Yeah. So
how do
just
we do
to,
this?
Yeah. So just to bring that up, and it's kind of why I brought this up as an example, because I think 2 or 3 years ago when La Sombrita happened, it was mocked by everyone, both sides of the aisle, everyone, even within LA. I was able to FOIA some of their information and in their internal messaging within LA workers or people who work for the city were like, don't promote this. Don't show it anymore. Like, this is bad. And the reason La Sombrita was born was because there are 9,000 something bus stops in LA. And if you've ever been to LA, it has wonderful weather, but you can bake in the sun for 20 minutes while you're waiting for a bus, especially with this urban heat island. And so the idea was, years ago, the city council was like, let's do a public-private partnership with, I forget which the advertising company is, but we'll build like thousands of these bus shelters that are state-of-the-art with like digital, you know, all that kind of stuff that you see in Europe, really, right? So let's do that. The problem was they allocated all this money and they had to wade through this bureaucracy. And in LA, as I point out in the piece, there are 10 governmental departments or city departments, and then 4 commissions outside of anything else that you have to, like, when anytime you do any sort of change, any sort of alterations to the street, you have to alert and go through the processes of all of these 10 different departments. And so that's why we haven't built any of these bus shelters we were promised, right? And so La Sombrita was designed in order to scapegoat all of the processes so that it could just be fixed on a pole that was already existing, so that like no process had to happen, which is crazy because the people who were there, the groundbreaking, I don't know the right words, groundbreaking, but like grand opening of this La Sombrita, they're also in charge of the processes that got them to this point. Like they are like being happy, or they're like jubilated at this idea of like, oh, look at this bus shelter that like we can build and implement really quickly because of the own processes that we look over are so bad. And that to me is just such a crazy irony. It's like, why are you patting yourself on the back of skirting around the own regulations and processes that you oversee and don't want to change? It doesn't make sense to me.
There's a photo that you use in the article, and it's just the look, there's four women standing underneath it, like if you can stand underneath this thing, and the look in their eyes is just surprise, shock, concern, worry. Are we serious? Like it's a phenomenal pitch.
And like the amount of cameras that are there, like the press that's there for this little metal sunshade that they call it, and it doesn't even provide shade at all whatsoever. So yeah, that's kind of where we found ourselves. And so a big part of the piece, I titled the piece 10 Principles for a New Democratic Urban Agenda Amid the Big Blue Reckoning. And it really was around the November election in the United States. Of a lot of people on a local level, especially in big cities, have seen a lack of delivery. And that lack of delivery is eroding public trust in both just the Democratic Party in general, but just also in our institutions. And globally, we are seeing this kind of rightward, authoritarian, slightly fascist, depending on how you define it, subscription kind of coming into the fold. And the reason they are is saying our institutions aren't working. They're failing us, right? And a lot of times the other side is almost coming off as pro-institution, but I try to reason in the piece that I also agree that they're deeply broken. I just don't agree on the solutions, right? Mm-hmm. And so what is that like give or take when you both can agree that the institution is failing, but you don't want to delegitimize it in a way in which they don't need it anymore, right? Because if I say to you, the MTA has a $68 billion capital program for 4 years, and it really won't make a difference in like the experience of, you know, an MTA rider, you would then, or, you know, the Elons and Doges, people of the world, the Viveks of the world would say, oh, great, so the MTA needs to close. But I'm like, no, 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 it needs massive reform, right? And so there's always been this kind of concern on my end, which I kind of needed some penance for. This is why I wrote the piece of trying to avoid talking bad about these institutions, because knowing these actors would then kind of take over the conversation and go, okay, great, so then you agree that we need to get rid of that. And I don't. So that's kind of been this push and pull.
I think there's an interesting thing around, a friend of mine was saying to me the other day, around that take Toronto on its bike lanes, and people like love to criticize the bike lane, especially if it wins you votes in suburbs. And it's actually almost, I wonder, if you have a city that destroys its institutions, does that become really good dystopian case study for hundreds of other cities to go, we're a bit like that, and if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to get eradicated. So we're going to have change conversation. So will Toronto stripping out its urban bike lanes be the best case study in the world for more bike lanes? And I wonder if, like, sadly, in America, will it be go down the path of we can cut this, and then suddenly we go, hang on a minute, we've got all these lovely autonomous Teslas, but we spend all of our day sitting inside them, going anywhere. Maybe we need this thing called a train. And will that help another bit of America solve that problem? Or will it help Canada go, let's not do what they did, because we love to do that in Canada, is define ourselves by what somebody else isn't. I wonder almost, is there a case of, do you have to rebuild by a bit of destruction to go and change these institutions that you can't just keep sort of band-aiding them effectively?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I do think that, and I write in the piece, is that we can't be afraid to rebuild these institutions. These institutions are kind of full of like crust. They're full of like things that we cared about or that we should have cared about decades ago that maybe aren't pertinent today. And the way that I like to think of, and I kind of think about it in the piece, is if you look at any sort of agency or any sort of government function and go, let's build the MTA today to fit the needs of New York City and the greater New York region, you probably wouldn't have the agency look and be structured the way it is, right? And so if you start thinking of it that way, you're kind of wondering like, well, we've always done it this way. Like I've worked within agencies that will always say like, well, we've always done it this way. And so why change? And that's a huge problem. And the reason that I'm really, really strongly talking about this is let's talk about high-speed rail for a second. California high-speed rail. No one, I think it's an unbelievable project. I think it absolutely should happen. I will be the first one to tell you that I think the way that it's been planned, the way that it was designed, the way it's been governed has been an unmitigated mess. There's no question about it. And the problem is, because we didn't get it right from the inception, and that we didn't have the governance in place to empower the agency to actually do stuff, to build state capacity, to actually clear environmental law so that we're not focusing on, I think there's like an underwater sound plan for the bay while trains run on existing right of, we're not even building new tracks. And California High Speed Rail has to do an underwater sound mitigation plan. Because we threw so much guck into it and we allowed public and bad actors in the public who didn't want the project to happen to sue and block the project, the Trump administration is coming in and they want to cancel because they see it's irredeemable, right? And so that's the push and pull I'm talking about, is if we're able to provide a level of, provide a service and project delivery as a country, as a government, as a state, we can then build the trust so that when bad actors come in and say, you know what, this project is such a mess, and I go, yeah, you're kind of right, I can't lie to you, but I still want it to happen. Their solution is to cancel it. My solution is to fix it, like work within it to figure out how we can deliver high-speed rail at scale throughout the country instead, right? And so that's this push and pull I keep bringing up.
There's a really interesting example of that in the UK, like High-Speed 2 in the UK is a disaster. And they spent 100 million quid on a tunnel for bats where there might not actually be any bats.
Yeah, a tunnel under a tunnel in farms because the farmers didn't want to see the tracks. I'm sorry, what?
What are we doing here? But they also started from this perspective of, I was trying to understand this and then someone explained it really, really nicely on something I was listening to, but it was the way the French have built their TGV, and TGVs in France are amazing. The rest of the trains kind of suck. But like the way that they've done it is they've got a set amount of money that they'll always spend. So when they start it, they go, right, with this money, we can build from here to here. And then when we build that, we'll build the next bit from here to here. And it's almost, it's always additive. And like over time, it becomes a net. Whereas what the Brits have done, and I think what the Americans are doing in places, is very much like, here's the big golden dream. And then we'll just start lopping pieces off of it when the cost starts to spiral. And then people can, and by the time it's finished, it ends up being a thing that I assume that California High Speed Rail won't ever actually make it to LA or San Francisco. And it'll be some weird thing in the middle that no one ever uses. And I hope I'm wrong. But like, that's what happened in the UK.
I don't think you're wrong.
I'm terrified.
And I can't tell you, I can't assuage your concerns, right?
Yeah. And I'm terrified that Canadians will make the same mistake with their train from Quebec to Toronto, because again, it follows the same sort of principles of, do we know what we're building? Do we know how we're building it? And do we know how to, like, what do we actually need to do to build this thing? What has to be true to build it? Screw the rest.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. And so I totally agree with you. When we talk a little, I talk a little bit about in the piece about, like, also we talk about like think region. We always talk about these like one-off projects, but we never sit and go, we want to build, like Cincinnati wants to build a metro network. Let's hire a bunch of engineers, or let's get the Cincinnati government or local government or the state to hire a bunch of engineers who are experts in the field, have them sit down, have them do the planning, have them do the engineering before it goes out to bid, so that consultants aren't doing the rest of all of that design and having to go through that process. And let's do a lot of this work in-house. And then once we build out this network in Cincinnati that we have with like in-house capacity, they can move on to the next city within Ohio or the next place, right? And so you kind of have this continuity. Whereas, for instance, as you were bringing up TJV, you know, do incremental changes or incremental additions. If we were doing that in the States, every addition would be a whole new planning process, a whole new public outreach process, all new consultants, all new engineers, all new designers who have to like get up to speed as to how the, like how it works, how things work. And in Italy, that's not. And in Italy and Spain and a bunch of these countries, they have in-house experts who go from project to project, highways, transit, on all of these things, and they're able to centralize it and just move on to the next project. They already know the requirements. They already know all of these things. And you pay them like, you know, a great salary, and it's less than what, you know, the consultant margin is. And we just don't do that in the States because we're afraid of state capacity. It's been gutted since the 80s in this country. And it shows because we can't build crap. I bring up that, you know, MTA spent $30 million on a staircase. $30 million on a staircase. And in Italy, you can build in Milan about 2.5 subway stations for that. Like, what are we doing here? Like, what are we doing here, right? So, and when the MTA wants money or they want to do congestion pricing, something that I support, and then, someone who's in opposition of it goes, well, the MTA needs to spend their money better. I go, you're not wrong, mm-hmm. but I still support congestion pricing, right? Like, you could see the issue there.
And we end up having this silly argument over, should we do this or should we not do this? When actually, like, often the thing is, we should be doing multiple things. And it's the time gets lost into studies. And like, I think I've been living in Canada for 7 or 8 years now, and I've been working here for 10. But like, there's always a study about another study. And you're like, if you'd just gone and started building the thing, we could study whether has it worked, rather than hypothetically studying whether it would work or not.
Yeah.
And you look at virtually every line I think has been built in most places, like, especially, or at least let me revise that. Look at most things that have been built outside of North America, and more often than not, the usage of them is above what they predicted. Whereas in America and in Canada, the usage of the line ends up being below. And I don't think the predictions are crazy. I think it's actually just more of like, we planned it to death to the point where actually it was no longer a good project, not planned it to make it a better.
Yeah, some of these projects, like the money just doesn't, or the cost just doesn't pencil out, especially when you keep studying it forever. The cost of doing all of those studies gets to the point where you're like, this is actually not a good project anymore. The only thing that I would probably push back on that slightly is that, Amtrak right now in 2024 has had its highest ridership since it was founded in 1971. And that was because we've invested it. We've run more trains. We've run more service. And like Brightline in Florida, and which will happen in LA to Las Vegas, there's been a tremendous demand. I just saw yesterday, Brightline, I think is 20-something% increase year over year. So there is a lot of demand for it. There's just not a demand politically to go through the pains of building the first high-speed rail line, because we keep getting in front of ourselves and we can't do these things correctly. And it's very, 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 very frustrating, as you and I both know. You brought up one thing about studies and policies, and I agree. I bring up in the piece, stop study. Just do. Stop it. You know, we've studied Chicago as a hub for high-speed rail almost 12 times since 1970, and now they're doing it again. Like, I don't know what you're getting different. Every time it says it's a good idea. 1993, there was like a study to go from Chicago to Minneapolis with like 300 mile per hour, like bullet trains. And it said in the conclusion, great idea, do it. Never did. And we've studied it multiple times over. So I'm like, what are you studying? One thing that is really, really stuck with me, and I add it into the piece, is by Jennifer Palka. She was the director of Code for America. And she said, political elites celebrate policy and the public feels delivered. And I think that's so true. We always talk about how great this policy is, how great this bill is, how great this new funding is, but we never talk about the actual delivery of it. And like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, they had a massive infrastructure bill, the biggest in the country's history. Most of it hasn't like opened, right? Because they were so excited about spending all of this money and all of this investment. But the big problem is part of the bill, and something that I recommend going forward, is you need to, within the bill, also talk about how it will be implemented and what processes need to be moved as part of that in order to see it implemented. And that's not something we do. We just like, okay, here's all this money, go build, you know, all these great things. And that just doesn't work. It's clearly not working.
It's interesting, the lived experience of going and doing a thing is often more powerful in making the case for building and doing the thing and spending millions or billions on it. I've talked about this before. I'm like, I've been told, and I haven't got this confirmed, but Italian high-speed rail, a huge amount of the case for doing that was the idea that you could live in Bologna, have lunch in Florence, and go see the opera in Verona in the same day, which was like, previously impossible. And I'm like, I don't know if that's entirely true or not, but it's that idea. I went to Bologna last year, and you can get to Florence about 40 minutes. It's really cheap. You just walk up and buy a ticket.
Wonderful.
Once you've done that, you then have to look at it and go, why the hell can't I live in Milwaukee and get to Chicago for lunch? Like that, like on the train. like that, and that to me is still like really weird of North Americans haven't gone and experienced that thing. And once you've experienced it and your city has that, the way that you interact with your city radically changes. I've seen it a little bit in Americans with like the new LaGuardia is probably the best case of this.
Yeah.
I feel like Americans accepted airports were shit. Like airports were just crap.
Yeah,
even if they
point.
Went to Singapore, like they still accepted American airports are crap. But now they've seen, hang on, we can have a nice airport. Why is like, why does New York get to have a nice LaGuardia and I don't get to have a nice picky place, Detroit? Like, we can do these things better. And that's opening our eyes to actually being like, okay, so do it. Let's go do it. And that gives me some hope.
Yeah, it's really funny they bring that up because I always think that too of like, why do airports or like the state of airports, you know, garner so much money and political support and then it's never the same for real. And I just think, again, it's one of those things where there's such a shared experience in America around flying and, you know, how often people fly. And people don't get that with passenger rail because this is not something that we really have in a way that's transformative or can move people. Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's one of those things where I always bring up to people, like when the World Cup is going to happen in North America, you know, it's happening in Canada and the United States and Mexico. I'm like, what is your expectations for like 50,000 people like landing at an airport? Then what? Are they going to like go to a suburban Kansas City parking lot arena? How are they getting? Like, are you not embarrassed? Like, I think about this all the time. How are they getting there? Like, are some of these people coming from Germany and they've taken what? 150 different routes to get to Frankfurt Airport because Frankfurt Airport has like 150 different bus routes, high-speed rail routes, all of these things going to it. And then they land in Kansas City. And then what? A bus that comes every hour? Are you not embarrassed? Like, genuinely, like, as a country, are you not embarrassed?
The stadium thing is, the stadium and the sports thing is really fascinating because we went through this like thing in the 90s of you go put your new arena on the outskirts of the town and all of those places are now going, how do we build a stadium district near the downtown? Like Ottawa is going through this at the moment.
Yeah.
I think Ottawa must have the worst located hockey arena in the NHL. Way out in the boonies and you could only drive there. And then now they're like bringing it back downtown at an enormous expense. But it's like, this should have been obvious. Like, it's amazing we weren't there already. But then, like, actually, when you do that, like, you open your eyes to, like, here are the other things that we can do. Here's how you can live differently. Here's what offices could be different. Here's how restaurants can be different. Like, the one I always come to is the Ajax Stadium in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real encouragement of hang around after the game, have some food, have some beers, like, stay around the stadium. So then we don't overload the transit to get you away. But it then feels like you spent no time queuing. There's no time waiting around. It's lovely.
Yeah. And is the expectation that people are just going to go to an arena and get completely like bombed out of their minds and then what? Sit in a parking lot for 2 hours? Like the great thing about like Boston is outside of the Patriots Stadium, like you go to the Red Sox, it's an entire experience. The experience around going to the Red Sox is not even just within the stadium itself. It's the bars that are like right across the street. All the shops, the walking, like you take the two different trains to get there. Like that has always been the experience, is like the experience outside of it. And then it's like, why do you want a parking lot like for tailgating? Like really, tailgating is that big that like we need parking lots the size of like lower Manhattan? Like we really, that's the best thing that we can do. So yeah, I totally agree. I think that's the hard part is like a lot of times people culturally be like, well, I go to Italy or I go to France to experience a walkable environment. I don't have it.
The Brit.
Why can't you have that here? I don't understand.
It's baffling. As a Brit, I adore a tailgate because it's such a novel thing. It's novel to me now. I've been here for 10 years. Like, I'm kind of over actually like a little, a stadium like tucked away in a residential neighborhood. I'm more into that because it's got
I totally understand. Yeah.
But the, like, it's that sort of thing of like, I don't get the, I go to like somewhere else to have this experience. And when I come home, there's like a whole trend at the moment of like TikToks and Instagrams of people going like,
yeah,
this is my reaction when I come home from Germany as an American. And you're like, I can't tell if you're celebrating this or is this the start of a shift of going, it's really weird we don't do it that way. How can we borrow some of that and apply it to our landscape? Like, don't know where we are.
Yeah, I so the the first tweet that I ever posted that really got traction and really started like the transit guy from just being like an Adele fan account to basically like the public transit stuff that I tweet about today was me talking about Disney World. And I'm like, 19 million people walk down Main Street in Magic Kingdom in Orlando, Florida, which is like a car dependent nightmare. Orlando's great, but it's a car dependent nightmare. All from across the world, like all from across the world, especially across from the country. And they go to these like walkable means. She's like, how cute is this? Like how cute it is. And people don't realize that like Walt Disney designed Main Street based off of his own childhood town that he grew up in Marceline, Missouri. Like, and that Main Street is still there, albeit very, very sad relative to maybe what it was. And so it's like, we had these things and now we like use them as theme parks. But we had them and we could still have them today. I think a lot of people don't realize how critical zoning is and regulations are. And I think a lot of times when people see like the suburbs and they see like the strip malls and like the Chipotles with the beige colors on the side, like, I mean, you see it in Mississauga and like Brampton, like all these places, like you see this kind of, you know, just strip mall. I think a lot of people genuinely think like the market is calling for that. Versus like, oh, no, we've actually regulated them to look like this. Our built environment looks like this because of zoning. And I think people think a lot of times, like as a quip, when I bring up, you know, why don't we have the nice things that Italy has with walkability, well, people, they don't want it here. And it's like, but that's actually incorrect. And if they did want it here, then get rid of zoning. And if nothing changed, then you'd be correct.
I think there'd be a fascinating social experiment if America just... This is the little... I'm very critical of Doge because I think it's a very stupid idea of people just telling you to get rid of this because it's not efficient. And you suddenly realize it does a load of really important things that couldn't be measured on a spreadsheet.
Oh, yeah.
But let's just say you burn all the regulations. Just went bugger the lot of them. We don't need all of this. And each sense state applied their character, their resources, their culture to building something. I think it'd be fascinating because there's still an interesting thing of like red states build housing at the moment. It might not be housing that I want to live in, but like they build housing.
Yeah.
Whereas blue states don't build housing.
And then they
act like their shit smells better than somebody else's. And yet they've got greater social problems than somewhere else because they've not built any housing. I'm kind of fascinated. If you burn a lot of the institution to the ground, are there some sort of green, fresh shoots that come back out of it? Then she like, all right, fair enough, Elon. Maybe you and Donald aren't the worst thing in the world for some things.
Well, I mean, I'm the first to tell you, as someone who's worked in and around government, I think there is a ton of efficiency that needs to happen. And also just a ton of updating, as I know Elon's brought it up, of like, there is some legacy software that like is not even used today. And it's the backbone of the federal government. Like, that's crazy. Like, that's absolutely wild. And we should change things like that, right? Like that's obvious. And so, yeah, there are tons of regulations. One of the things I bring up in the piece is that this is true for places like Toronto. This is definitely true for America, is that a lot of politicians, they think that the average voter cares about the process and not the outcome. Like the process to getting a house built in or a permit today in San Francisco is almost double that it took to build the Empire State Building. Like, what are we doing here? And a lot of times people or politicians and whatnot will cling on to that process as if it's a policy choice, as if it's something like you're voting on, and it's not. It doesn't help, right? And so if we want to, we can do those things for like, you know, nightclubs or things that may be somewhat off color. But like doing this for, as I bring up in the piece, there was an ice cream shop in San Francisco that was vacant, or it was just a storefront that was vacant in an existing neighborhood of the Mission. I don't know if anyone's ever been. Mission's a beautiful neighborhood in San Francisco. This gentleman wanted, a San Francisco native wanted to build a ice cream shop within it. And in order to do that, he needed to notify every person within 150 feet from the existing storefront. He did that. And then one of all of those people had an issue with it. And then he had to go through a whole planning process, and 60 something busybodies went to this planning meeting to like talk in favor or oppose it. And I'm like, what part of government, like, why are we even giving people the option to? I have a million problems in my life. None of them are if someone wants to make the business decision to build an ice cream thing. And I think that is the big problem of, and also he never because it was so onerous and because there were so many permitting and whatnot, he decided to back out after $150,000 invested. And 5 years later, it's still empty. It's still an empty. So like, who did that help? Like, if we talk about that on like a human level, who benefited from that?
There's a process thing that the process has been designed. So where's the outlier for the no? The process hasn't been designed for the outlier for the yes. Mm. And I find like that sort of, why do we do that? Like it's, and you look at it in companies and like people like behave in a risk averse manner because they don't want to be blamed. And it's like that but on steroids in the public sector and in government, because we don't want someone to be upset that there's going to be a kid screaming because their ice cream fell on the floor and it's going to wake them up because they work on a night shift. Like, don't live in a city. If that's you shouldn't be living in a city. You should be go live in Missouri. Go live in the boonies.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And I think another kind of through line is this homeowner versus renter, this homeowner versus like non-homeowner political argument that we constantly have, where entrenched homeowners who like have been there, who don't want progress, who don't want housing, they're the most reliable voters because they don't move, right? Like, I've moved multiple times in my life, so I've had multiple different council members, different district supervisors, like all of these things. And so really, they can't count on me for a vote in the next election because I might move because of my like housing insecure, right? And so that's the big problem too, of like, we have this big, you know, group of people who might be pissed at us if we build more housing. And so that's kind of like where the incentive structure is. I just saw today, would you want to guess how many apartments have broken ground in the month of November in 2024 in Los Angeles, the second biggest city in the biggest economy in the world?
I'm going to guess it's very low.
20.
Is that it?
20. 2-0. And I just tweeted, since 2010, the Tokyo metro area has added 350,000 more homes than Los Angeles has in total. What are we doing here? Like, what are we doing here? Are we not being serious? And the reason most of the, wrenches that have been thrown in recently in LA City Council have been, oh, well, you know, the process has been wrong or the outreach has been incorrect. And it hasn't. It hasn't. It's just, you don't want it to happen. And so you blame the process. Or if you don't want something to happen, you throw more process in order to not make it happen. And I think that's like a really funny through line. And I'm sure you probably know about the I-95.
Yeah.
Basically, Governor Shapiro of Pennsylvania and Joe Biden, they were so happy. They brought it up constantly in their campaigns, this year about, oh, we got I-95 rebuilt in a week. And we would still be planning and working on it today if we went through the normal processes. And I'm like, I don't understand this, because you are sitting here and saying on a national stage, you have skirted the processes that you manage and oversee as a way of like political, like, you know, celebrate me politically. And it's like, yes, and people did, and everyone thought that was great. And so it's like, well, why are you keeping all of these processes then? Still,
it was celebrating your own mediocrity.
Yes, I'm celebrating skirting the thing that I am implementing. It doesn't make any sense at all. It's a silly, like, you would never do that to your boss, of being like, oh, I got around a process that I own that makes no sense. Celebrate. So then why do you have the process?
There's a thing of, I do this a lot with clients, but it's like, what do we want to keep doing? What do we want to start doing? But really, most importantly, what do we want to stop doing?
Mm.
Because it's like all of the, like, anything new tends to be additive, but it's very easy to add things and it's very hard to take things away.
Right.
And like, I'm doing a thing at the moment where like I'm trying to install a piece of like lighting and sound equipment into transit stations. And I'm very aware that what I'm doing in the course of a trial is adding more sign, that the reason the product I create exists is because the signage in transit systems tends to be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm doing to solve the problem in my trial is I'm adding more noise, whereas what my product is designed to do is allow you to take away the noise. And I think that that's the thing of like, we always make these new things, but we never then go, right, if we're going to do that, do we still need this?
Mm-hmm.
I always thought the best example for that in Canada was like housing around like rules for exits and elevators. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was due to fire hazards. But like when the rules were created, like most things were very flammable. And now things are not very flammable. We have sprinkler systems and we have much better fire response. So do we still need that? And like that's the thing that we never took away the rule that doesn't need to exist anymore.
Yeah, I forget which state it is. I think it might be Idaho, but Idaho has a rule that almost all regulations sunset after a decade. And I kind of like that idea of looking at all of your regulations and voting as to whether you still need them. There's still a lot of the regulations we have are reactionary, and they're reactionary from things that happened in the 50s. Like in New York City, we're like having this massive argument about parking minimums and if we should get rid of them. And I asked, where did we even come up with the parking minimums? Like, what was it? Like, where did this number come from? Literally, if you look at the zoning code, it came from 19. Literally, it says within it, like, this was implemented in the 90s, and we never have looked at it in 80 years. And you're like, I don't understand why we're still mandating in the year of our Lord 2024, where Uber and all these other ride-hailing systems exist. Why are we still mandating something from the 90s? Why are we not looking at it in today? And so I think, and I'm going to say this very, treading very lightly with all of the disclaimers, that is the approach that I appreciate of Donald Trump. I would never vote for him. I don't like the MAGA movement, all of that. But I appreciate the not being okay with things not working and being like, okay, so let's fix them or let's blow them up. I don't think what he will do will fix anything. I will think it'll provide austerity and make things. But the approach of, well, you know, we have to keep funding the MTA at insane levels that could rebuild the system. In other countries, if we give other countries that amount of money, $68 billion, they could rebuild the system multiple times over. And we keep giving the money to these major agencies that are just broken, hoping that they'll somehow reform themselves and fix. And a lot of times that's just not how it's going to work. And so I think we're all kind of eye-opened.
There's a thing with like that the Republican Party was always seen as the conservatives. Like, these are the people who want to preserve the way the world was. And now the world has flipped where we've had the Democrats being like, they're not to pretend to be progressive, but they're not progressive.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen the same thing in like other countries. They can choose the labels that they use for their parties. But the traditionally conservative group of people have suddenly become very not conservative, small C conservatives. And they're now going like, how do we radically change the way we do things? And weirdly, they get destructive, like coming back to what we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
But like, I really hope like the response to that force isn't we must preserve everything. I hope the response is, yes, we do need to change, but we're going to change it in a totally more positive way in which you're talking about it.
Yeah.
I think that's the optimistic thought of us.
Yeah, and I think a lot of there's already been a lot of slack in conversation around Democratic politicians already in Congress talking with Elon and all of these things about fixing regulations. And most of the regulations they're talking about fixing, I totally agree with. Like Bernie Sanders talking about, like, yeah, we spend a ridiculous amount of money on defense spending. Like, there is so much waste. Let's destroy the military industrial complex. You got me. I'm good, right? Like, cool. Or if I can, you know, do anything with making environmental clearance easier for transit projects, if that's something Doge wants to do, I will be Doge's biggest warrior for that project, right? Like, I'm not going to sit in the way of progress just for political gain and kind of tribalship. And so that's kind of what I am slightly excited for, is maybe we're able to kind of revisit some of these conversations of, hey, we really haven't been able to build anything as a country, and we need to fix that desperately. And how do we do it? And how do we dismantle it?
I was at a conference last week and they talked about the sort of what we need to shift towards is a housing industrial complex. But I thought it was like the thing that when I started doing these conversations, I really wanted to get big corporate organizations like grocery stores, retailers, airlines, CPG companies.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get them involved in this because actually like the way that you change the world is by redesigning cities.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, you actually need a lot of private capital behind it. You need a grocery, like to your point of saying, if you design the MTA today, it wouldn't look like anything like the MTA does it. The same is true for a city, the same is true for a grocery store, the same is true for pick any brand that you interact with. Actually, like they should be the ones that really care about this, but I don't see a ton of enthusiasm for it. And I wonder how we get to that sort of complex of here's where government and the private sector work in harmony to reboot the economy effectively, that it was the military that kicked this off way, way back in the 40s.
Yeah, and I think it is. I think it's, again, as I said, like these islands of blue, either states or our local cities, really being able to regain that trust in showing people. And I don't think that's going to be something that like we can do immediately. I do think it's something we're going to have to kind of do slowly. I brought this up on a recent podcast, but, you know, one of the reasons I think Kamala Harris lost was that she talked a lot of great policy, and most voters agreed with her policies. Most did, like blindly, if you were like, you know, do you agree with this? Like, even Trump voters, right? I think the problem was they didn't believe that she could get it implemented. They believed the policy, but they didn't think that she could get it implemented. And if you are living in LA and the second biggest city in the biggest economy on the planet can't build a bus shelter, then why are you talking to them about Medicare for all? Think about that. Like, yeah, we're going to revitalize and nationalize our healthcare system, but we can't build a bus shelter. Like, and so it's like little things like that, which I think is really kind of why, you know, Democrats lost, or at least they saw a huge swing against them, especially pronounced in cities of like, yeah, no, it's taken. Why is like our bike plan is like 30% of the progress. And we have like a year left in New York City. Like, why? How hard is it to bike lanes? Yeah. Right. It's those little things that I think are really going to matter. And one thing that is giving me some concern, and I think it's coming from this Gavin Newsom mostly, is there's a lot of like the thought process now amongst liberals and people on the left, or just, you know, center left, whatever, is resist. And I think there are things that absolutely will happen federal level that we should resist. I think where I would push back on Gavin Newsom is like, oh, we are going to do everything we can to stop Trump at all times. And what I would like Gavin Newsom and all of these blue states to do is show the alternative of Trump. Like, have LA and SF and all of these places within California and Boston and New York City and all of these places show people what the alternative is to Trump at a local state level. And they haven't done that. And I think that's where you need to go. Don't just resist politically just because you think that's what it wants. People want to see you actually deliver the policies that you want to do federally. And I think that's a really, really big thing that is giving me concern.
We touched on sports stadiums earlier, but I think, like, I totally agree with you. I don't see, like, those more Democrat, left-leaning cities having the... They don't have a vision for what they want to be, where they're going to go, what happens next. Like, you touched it in your piece again, Eric Adams, like, being like, here's a bin. Like, yes, Eric, we know what they are. They work quite well in many places. But these cities, they don't have a big vision for, like, here's what we're aspiring towards. I think the one thing that gives me hope is LA and the Olympics. When he talks about this system being car-free Olympics. Really? I don't believe you for a second that LA is going to be a car-free Olympics.
No.
But I do see that that is the thing that is giving LA just enough to be able to go and do something that is going to be different and a little bit more, like, it has a bigger social impact effectively than anything else that I can see in American cities.
Yeah. And also, I think Seattle as well, as they're building out their transit system, they are building at a pretty large clip at this point. I do think, you know, things like that help buy in a lot of, oh, this is what we can have, right? So yeah, I'm hopeful, especially on a local level. I mean, I've talked to a bunch of Democrats, both elected officials and at a local level, and just, you know, voters who I think have seen kind of this vibe shift. And we talked a little bit about like the abundance agenda is kind of what it's been called. But like, no, we need to be the party of like, building things, and that's going to be hard, and give us time to rebuild all of these institutions or reform them. But we're not going to shut up about it anymore, because clearly it's a big enough problem to where, you know, we got our butts whooped. So it's something we need to fix.
I like to end these things on, like, if you could wave a magic wand, what's the thing that you would want to shift or change or wish for or command with that?
I love this question. I think what I would like to see is so many. Gosh. I think what I would like to see is a national vision for transportation, of what like transportation should look like. I'm sick of like these one-off projects that like slightly build a metro system out every like 30 years. I would really like to see an interconnected system of, this is what America can look like in insert 2040, and have something at a local level, at a regional level, and at a state and federal level. Switzerland does, and it's really, really cool. They know exactly the clock face schedules 10 years from now. And from that, they go, okay, let's reverse engineer. Like, if these two cities are going to get two more trains an hour, what do we need to do? And they reverse engineer. And that's not something we do at all in this country. And then I think the second thing that I would like this country to do is the politicians to not make policy, is for politicians to seek out policy. There are so many good like bureaucrats and advocates and knowledge and subject matter experts who have great ideas, and we should be a country, and I don't think politicians do this anywhere, where politicians actually listen to best practices and do it versus, oh, I'd love to see this high-speed rail project. Like, we should not be having, we should have the DOT in this country being like, here's what this country needs. Here's based on our research, based on this, like, okay, great. And then politicians figure out a way to get it done versus the opposite. Politicians are telling people what to do. And that's very, very frustrating.
I'm going
to
do a whole other episode of one of these. And like, actually, what is policy? Where does it fail? What should policy be? And then how do you turn policy into like proposition and action?
Yeah.
Because I think that's like, I hear the word policy and my eyes glaze out, to be honest. Because like, they shouldn't. It shouldn't be like that. But
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Hayden, you've been amazing. Thanks so much for like taking the time to like do this with me today. I really appreciate it.
I'll put a link to your piece in the show notes. Thank you.
Here's to doing this again. Hopefully when you're sort of pulling the strings as a Democrat to actually go build things.
Yeah, when I'm the US DOT secretary. No big deal.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers, mate. Thank you so much for listening to another one of these hour-ish long episodes all about trying to help make cities become the challengers. Before you go, I do need a little bit of help. So I want to get this thing to get out there in the world, get a bit of traction. So do like, share, review it, send it to a friend, plug it on LinkedIn, Twitter, Blue Sky, whichever your social media poison is. Because I hope you've enjoyed listening to it because you got to this far. And if you're listening to me now, I probably think you did enjoy it. So yes, let's take this thing bigger, broader, further, wider. And once again, thank you for listening. And I'll see you on another episode very, very soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.